Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled An Intimate Conversation with Jim Lara, Part 1. Recorded in 2002, Dennis McQuistion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, interviews Jim Lara, anchor and executive editor of PBS's The NewsHour with Jim Lara. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, it's not every day that I get to introduce someone who literally needs no introduction. Jim Lehrer is, a household name if you're into television at all, and certainly if you're into PBS. The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer is on Monday through Friday and has been on for, I guess, about 27 years now. Is that right, Jim?
That's right, Dennis.
In one name or the other, as
exactly.
We might point out.
Exactly.
We're going to come back to that in just a minute. But I want you to, first of all, tell that viewer where you're sitting right now and sort of the history that goes into why you're here in Dallas right now.
I am sitting in the studio where where it all started for me in 1970. I was a newspaper man here in Dallas working for the Dallas Times Herald, and a novel I had written was made into a movie, and I made $45,000, and my wife and I decided we could live for 4 years on that, and I was going to write full time. And the then manager of the public of KERA, Bob Wilson, called me and asked me if I would agree to work 2 days a week as a consultant on news and public affairs. One thing led to another. Bob had an idea also to take to Dallas an idea that had been started in San Francisco for a newsroom, a nightly news experimental program, and so we did it. And that's what got me into television. And I've just it's amazing to be back here and realize how little I knew about television and how exciting it all was and what it's all led to.
Well, it has led to an incredible experience with you and obviously for all of us who watch you on TV on a regular basis. But let me take that viewer back to your roots, really. Take us back to Kansas and bring us through Texas and then tell us who you were with here in Texas before you actually went with the Dallas Times Herald.
I was born in Wichita, Kansas. My father was in the bus business all his adult life. I began working for Santa Fe Trailways when he died in 1970. In fact, he died just as this program, my newsroom program, was beginning. But he never really got to see me on TV. It's one of the things I always regret, the side here. But anyhow, he was manager of the Trailways Bus Depot in San Antonio when he died. Anyhow, we moved from Kansas to Texas when I was 12, 13 years old, moved to Beaumont, and then from Beaumont to San Antonio, where I finished high school, and then went to Victoria College, mm-hmm. It's a junior college, down on the Gulf Coast, halfway between Houston and Corpus, and I went there for 2 years, and by then I was already into a life that I wanted to live as a writer and as a journalist. And so I went to the journalism school at the University of Missouri, a place I'd never been. I just wrote to them and got in with the help of a great dean of this little school in Victoria, Texas, who helped me get in. They wouldn't take my credits because they'd never heard of the school.
Of course.
And I was supposed to go in as a junior because I'd been a freshman and a sophomore. And they said that, oh, we'll accept you only as a provisional sophomore. And it infuriated this wonderful man who was the dean. And so what he said to them, he said, do you really want to go to Missouri, Jim? And I said, yes, sir, I really do. And he said, well, let's roll the dice with these guys. And so anyhow, make a long story short, he wrote this admissions officer at Missouri and said, look, you send exams to us. We'll administer them and all the subjects you need to take this kid as a junior. And if he passes them, will you admit him as a junior? So this guy, some guy, a wonderful guy in the admissions office, said, okay, we'll take you up on it. They sent the test. I aced them, and I was admitted as a senior junior, in fact.
Amazing.
And, but it was all because this one man. Yeah. We all have stories like that where somebody believed in you and all that. But at any rate, I then graduated from Missouri, was in the Marine Corps for 3 years, was an infantry officer in the Marine Corps, came out, went to work for the Dallas News, worked for the Dallas News for a couple of years, then went to the Times Herald. And then, as I said, I was city editor when I left the Times Herald and came over here.
That's a very interesting story about the guy who believed in you. But when you came back here and worked for the Dallas Morning News, there's some story behind why someone would leave the Dallas Morning News and go to the Dallas Times Herald. Tell me about that.
Well, I had written a series of articles about the civil defense organization here in Dallas, and the story was essentially that it had become more interested in putting out what was considered then to be kind of right-wing propaganda. Whether it was or not was in the eye of the reader or the propagander. Mm-hmm. And at any rate, the Dallas News wouldn't run the series. And so I quit and went across town, went to work for the Times Herald. And the real hero of that story is not me, is my wife, Kate. I mean, we had one little girl and another one on the way. I didn't know it was back in those days, you didn't know it was going to be a girl. But anyhow, she said, well, you just come on home. And so I did. And I didn't know when I literally walked out of the office that day at the newsroom of the Dallas News, did not know for sure I had a job at the Times Herald. And that was an interesting time.
It certainly was an interesting time. Now, you got here, and the newsroom thing is something that those of us in Dallas remember. But tell us just a bit about what newsroom was trying to do at that time.
Well, it was a kind of an interesting program in that none of the people involved in it, first of all, me, knew anything at all about television. Didn't have a prayer as to what we were doing. And it was all black and white. And somebody said to me, well, let's start the program. Let's make the theme song going in, Here Comes the Sun, the Beatles song. And I said, fine. And we could close it with Oh Happy Day with the Hawkins Singers. So we had a news program. It began Oh Happy Day, and it closed. It ended with Oh Happy Day, but it opened with Here Comes the Sun. The whole idea was the sun of light was, the light of the sun was going to come on, mm-hmm. on the deep dark secrets of Dallas, etc. At any rate, it was a program of, and I would say, good evening. Welcome to Newsroom, a program of news, analysis, and opinion. And we carefully labeled everything. And but all the emphasis was on local news. We covered the city hall and the courthouse. And we were the first news organization in Texas to have a black reporter, to have a Mexican-American reporter. We even had women reporting news other than society news,
exactly.
And we had an environmental reporter, the first of its kind, sure. in the Dallas area. We also Darwin Payne, who's still in Dallas, covered the media. In other words, he covered the newspapers, which was also very popular, as you can imagine, with
yes.
my two former employers.
Of course.
But anyhow, it was a very exciting. Time very difficult. I mean, I never worked so hard in my life, and we had crises all the time, and we didn't know how to shoot film. We didn't know any of that stuff, but it was successful in its own way. I mean, it didn't have a huge audience, but we became a factor in Dallas journalism because eventually, the editors at the two papers quit sitting on stories because they knew their reporters would slip them to us.
Interesting.
And so suddenly all these little games that these papers had played for years, oh, well, let's sit this story out, or, for the good of the community, whatever. Those all bets were off. Suddenly we would use it. And then that made it possible for the editors, I'm talking about the working editors, to say to their, hey, we better run this story because, those kooks over at Channel 13 will run it.
They'll run it if you don't.
Yeah, right.
Well, you have obviously learned so much between then and now. But you were in Dallas 5 years ago. You were in Dallas being honored as one of five Texas journalists by mm-hmm. TACA, the TACA Awards here. And I had the opportunity to interview you, Bob Schieffer, Dan Rather, Sam Donaldson, and let's see, who was the other one? Schieffer?
Moyers.
Moyers, of course.
Yep.
We did a
yep.
whole program with Bill Moyers
yeah.
while he was here.
Yeah.
And I asked you and the other journalist this question, and I want to play the tape of that in just a second. I asked you this question. I said, what is the most important responsibility of a journalist? Here's what you said in 1997, and here's what some of your colleagues said. Let's have a look at it.
Oh, I think find the truth, which is what that's always been the first responsibility or job of journalists, is to find the truth. I think also in a complicated world that we live in, we have a second responsibility, and that is to provide a forum to make it possible for people to examine all the public issues. And sometimes that sounds kind of dull and dreary, but we need to provide the information for people who want it. And so I think that's our second responsibility.
Nothing has changed. The role of the journalist has always been in a democratic society is to provide information to the people so they can make informed decisions when they vote, when they do other things that require their action in a democratic society. We are the information gatherers and dispensers, and nothing has changed.
Same as it's always been. The number one job is to be accurate and to be fair. Now, what's different today is the competitive pit is fiercer. It's even more unrelenting. It's even more unmerciful than it's ever been. And therefore, to survive, it's more difficult to do that and keep your core integrity than I think it's ever been.
To connect the dots, to help people see the relationship between what's on the surface and what's under the surface, between A leading to B and B leading to C, to connect the dots.
Well, that was 5 years ago. Anything changed since then?
Well, one thing that made me think of and seeing those clips first, Dennis, is I was asked one time by Liz Carpenter for an article she was doing for Texas Monthly, why is it that so many national TV anchor people come from Texas? And I said, well, Liz, it's because we're smarter than everybody else. That's why.
I agree with
that's
that.
That's my first reaction. No, if you asked me that question today, I would give you this exact same answer. I feel that that journalism is still the same thing it has always been, which is we, the journalists, go where the people cannot go on their own and report back to them so they can make informed decisions. Not so we can, so they can.
You made distinction a few moments ago when you were talking about newsroom, and you said it had to do with analysis and commentary. What is the difference today, and is there a slippery slope here between what that viewer could look at when you look at television and say, I'm looking for the news, I'm looking for objectivity, if that's one of the things I'm looking for here, I'm looking for reporting, versus I'm trying to determine whether there's really commentary in there that's not labeled as commentary?
Well, I happen to believe, Dennis, that there is some slipping going on. And it's the fact that, interesting, Rather made the comment, you know, about how competitive things have gotten. Well, that was 5 years ago.
Yes.
You take what it was 5 years ago, not in my particular part of television news, but in the world of commercial television news, including the cable news networks. Remember, when those things were done, when you were doing those interviews, there was no cable television news network. There was no CNN, for all practical. I mean, they were it. That was it,
that's
barely.
Right.
But there was no MSNBC, no Fox, and
true,
all that stuff. And now what has happened, the competition is so fierce, even more so than it was then, that I think there's an awful lot of commentary slip, you know, kind of, you know, well, we have to have an edge to our program. We have to have an edge to our stories and all of that, rather than just reporting. And I think down that road is the loss of credibility for whoever's doing it. Because I really believe very strongly that the journalism function, there are three functions. There is giving the news, there's providing analysis, and providing opinion. But they should be they're separate functions. The same person who gives the news shouldn't be doing the analysis, and sure as Dickens shouldn't be giving his or her opinion. And because the public, and this is, we gotta remember what we're doing this for. This isn't so I can become a big shot and I can get my picture on television or anything like that. This whole process of journalism is what is to do what Thomas Jefferson said. If the democratic society is going to function, you have to have an informed electorate. And that's what journalism was created to do, as a vehicle to help the electorate become informed. Simple. A, that's B, C, and D.
Are you as concerned as I am that we're losing an informed electorate for a lot of different reasons, not just because of journalism, that somehow we've ceased to be, as a society here, as educated as we need to be to keep this democracy and republic together?
Dennis, I'm not wise enough to know the answer to that. I do know that nobody can look me straight in the eye at least and say, oh my goodness, I just no place for me to get any information. I mean, the reason I don't know anything is because you people aren't providing. Baloney. There are more ways now to get information than there ever have been. I mean, with the cable news networks, with the internet, now we're about to have 500 channels, you know, digital, yes. All that sort of thing. And there are all kinds of specialty publications now. I mean, you just have to work at it a little harder. Remember several years ago, your thing illustrates it, there were three commercial networks and us.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That was it.
That's right.
And you would get together with people in the evening. Mm-hmm. And any group of people, it was a shared experience. Everybody had watched, you know, Huntley Brinkley or Cronkite, mm-hmm. or whatever, and everybody had the same pieces of information.
That seems to be the paradox here, though. By having somehow more information, we end up with less information. Am I making any sense there?
You are making a little sense. No, you are making sense there. But I'm not. I don't know. I don't know for a fact that people are less informed. I think there's some evidence that people aren't participating in some of the society institutions the way they used to, and maybe that's a result of not being informed. But I think it's not our fault. You see, I mean, not the little our fault. It's the big our fault if that's happening.
Exactly.
In other words, we haven't maybe gotten back. I think maybe all of this stuff is going to result maybe in a kind of a return to. Gatekeeper, somebody you can trust. Okay, I trust you. I've got a job. I got to go to school. I need somebody to go through all this stuff. I can't sit at my computer all day and check and do all this stuff.
Well,
so maybe
right.
We're going to go back to it.
Well, that may be true, but a lot of them try to get their news on the computer all day, and that's possible to do, as you know.
Sure.
Now, I want to. This is a book I think you said you hadn't read or hadn't seen in a while. It's called "Amusing Ourselves to Death," mm-hmm. written by Neil Postman, who's somebody you know, of course, and know of. Written in 1985, and his premise in this book is basically that we've lost any news, we've lost any putting events in context, as an example, issues in context and that sort of thing. And what he says in here is that we've become, because of television, we've basically taken books out of, you know, what you and I would read as books and sort of know something of common knowledge in the country. And television then has made it, because it is a form of entertainment, when we try to put news on it or even commentary on it or the kinds of things that we do mm-hmm. In trying to talk about issues, it all has to be in sound bites. It's all so quick, and it's because it appeals to people's, in some cases, baser instincts, and certainly the time issue, that it's all amusing ourselves to death. And that's what he talks about in here. Now, let me say what else he talks about here, because you don't know this. This is on page 105 and 106, and so...
If it's criticism, I don't want to hear it.
No, it's not. It's not. And he says he's talking about Robert McNeil.
Right.
And I'll ask you to bring Robert McNeil into the conversation in just a second. But he says the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour is an unusual and gracious attempt to bring to television some of the elements of typographic discourse. The program abjures visual stimulation, consists largely of extended explanations of events and in-depth interviews, which means they're 5 or 10 minutes. And so it limits the number of stories covered, and it emphasizes background and coherence. And he says, you guys are, and this was 1985, and you guys were an oasis in the desert. So bring Robert McNeil into this, first of all, and then tell us how you went from here to there, and then why you've sort of developed the 60-minute format, how important that is, if in fact it is important, and how you try to differentiate yourself in this world of say, images.
Well, Dennis, when we started, as a half-hour show, one story a night for 30 minutes, and then in 1983 we went to an hour. Now, the concept changed. I mean, our purpose changed. When we were one story a night, the idea was we were a supplement to the nightly news programs. Go watch somebody else's nightly news program and then come to us for one story. When we went to an hour in 1983, we said, uh-oh, now we're an alternative. You don't have to watch anybody else but us, and because we have a news summary and all that sort of stuff. Our thinking basically has not changed since 1983. What has changed is the environment in which we function. We look very unique now, but in 1983, we were not that unique. The nightly news programs on the commercial television networks were still basically serious news programs. This was pre-OJ. This was our news is better than your news. Hey, give me a break. Right. It's the same news, friends. Mm-hmm. And we're not there to entertain you. And as I tell people, you want to be entertained? Go to the circus. Don't watch our program. I'm not going to entertain you. Exactly. You know, get your laugh somewhere else. You know, that's not the business I'm in. Yeah. And but that philosophy was started by Robert McNeil. I mean, he's the one who said and convinced, because he had the clout. I didn't have the clout. I was a kid off the newsroom set in Dallas,
like,
right?
You know?
And he was a big NBC guy, and he had done all the stuff at the BBC and whatever. And his deal was that there was an audience for serious, for something a little more serious than it was then. And Postman, I love that, what you just read, by the way. But he's got it right. But that, we're still doing it. You know, 27 years later, Dennis, we're still doing it the same way. And it looks, oh my God, those people are really weird. Well, we also have a sizable audience compared with these cable news networks.
Well, tell us what kind of an audience you have and compare it to some of the cable
channels.
Well,
when we are on the air, our audience is larger than MSNBC, CNBC, CNN, and Fox News Channel combined.
Great.
Now, when there were just three commercial networks and us, our audience was considered in television terms very small. But now our audience is, you know, because the pie.
Sure.
I mean, my God. Yes. I mean, there's so many slices to the pie now. Mm-hmm. That our audience is considered large.
Surely you've had pressure, even on PBS, to dumb down the content, increase the pizzazz, throw in some celebrity interviews, etc.
No. N-O, no. Never happened. Nobody has ever had... I guess maybe they know that I'm a hothead or something, but nobody's ever had the courage to suggest anything like that to me, because they know if it happened, I would throw a fit that would make everything prior to that in their lives look mild. No, it is not what public broadcasting is about. Mm-hmm. It's not what we are about. It's not what the people who support public broadcasting want us to do. Mm-hmm. And this is what's so terrific about public broadcasting. As I told some folks earlier, in public broadcasting, things flow uphill rather than downhill. Mm-hmm. And the power is with the folks who support the local station. And the reason they support the local station is because we're not dumbing down.
Exactly.
So who are we dumbing down for? You know, I mean, what's the point here? We're dumbing down for some magic audience that's out there. The one problem I think we have in public broadcasting, and it's because the pie is so diverse now, so many cuts to it now, we have not done a good job of telling people about us. We still think, well, we're still operating like there's three networks and us. Mm-hmm. We need to tell people. We need to introduce ourselves to a lot of people who are not aware, you know, that there is PBS and what exactly they do and all that sort of stuff, because the folks that grew up in public broadcasting know about it, but there's some people who don't grow up in public broadcasting anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to be more aggressive. We just recently on the NewsHour done some national advertising, first we've ever done, and it's had an impact. And say, hey, look, here we are. There's an alternative, and you don't have to watch. It isn't just between these 18 people. There's also a 19th or whatever it is.
You have, I'm just going to say, honored. I'm going to use the word honored. I mean, you've won a bunch of Emmys and other awards. You've won all kinds of awards for your program over the years. But last, I guess it was in the 2000 elections, and certainly in elections before that, you have been asked, perhaps more than any other journalist, to moderate the presidential debates. Give us some sense of what that means to you, number one. What the responsibilities are, number two, and what goes through your mind when you're sitting there going, uh-oh, everybody's watching.
Well, I tell you, it is the most difficult work I have ever done. It is the most scariest work I've ever done, and I'll explain that in a minute, but it's also the most exhilarating and satisfying. Mm-hmm. For all the same reasons. It is not a television show. It isn't, you know, if I mess up one of these debates, I can't just look out at the camera and say, so sorry, I fouled this up. I'll see you here tomorrow night, and I'll try to do a little better. Who's going to be the next president of the United States?
Sure.
could be decided. And I've always two bottom lines when I've been moderating these debates. First of all, I want to make sure that nobody can ever get up, not forget the candidates and their handlers. The handlers, that's a whole other world. I don't care what they think. But I don't want any voter, any American who's watching it to be say, so-and-so was treated unfairly by Lara, by the moderator. And the other thing is, I don't want anybody ever to be able to write a story that says, Billy Bob Wawa or Sammy Sue Wawa is president of the United States today because the moderator of the debate did fill in the blank. And also, just conceptually, my view of it is it's not a function of journalism to moderate a presidential debate. I ask harsh follow-up questions. Mm-hmm. The rules don't usually allow it, but even if they did, I wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. I would not introduce new subjects. Mm-hmm. I've been criticized for this, but my view is that my job is a facilitator. And it's to make, if they want to debate, and if the candidates want to debate and they want to engage, that's their decision. All of America is watching, and I really believe that the viewers are just as smart as I am, and they can figure it out. Mm-hmm. If I ask somebody a question like, what day is it? And he says, that's not the question. The question is, what month is it? I'm thinking, okay. Viewers can figure that one out as well. And so it is, if somebody's talking about me when it's over with, then I really believe...
You haven't done your job if
exactly.
talking about you.
Exactly. They need to be talking about what the candidates mm-hmm. have said and done.
Thank you for joining us for part one of the interview with Jim Lehrer. Be sure and watch part two of the intimate conversation with Jim Lehrer as we continue talking about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Mm-hmm.